Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Laura Frederick. Laura is the founder and CEO of How to Contract, which helps lawyers and professionals learn how to draft and negotiate contracts in the real world, and managing attorney at Laura Frederick Law, PLLC, based in Austin, Texas. Laura's experience includes 11 years at large law firms and 14 years in-house at technology and energy companies like Tesla. During the pandemic, she started posting daily contracting tips in cartoon form on LinkedIn and has since published a book featuring a collection of the cartoon tips called Practical Tips on How to Contract, Techniques and Tactics from an Ex-Big Law, Ex-Tesla Commercial Contracts Attorney. It's been on the bestseller list and you can find it on Amazon. Laura, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk today. I'm so excited about having you on the podcast to talk about contracting. I know people might think it's boring, but I think it's great. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, appreciate you having me.
I really wanted to have you on the show today because contracting can be a really scary thing for folks in the third sector, particularly if they don't have legal resources to rely on, and they can get really nervous and get really scared that they're getting into something that might be over their head or people taking advantage of them. So if we can start out, can you let us know a little bit about your background? How'd you get into contracting? And we can go from there.
Oh, yeah. And I hear you on being intimidated by contracts. It's very common. And hopefully, as we talk, we can provide some information so people aren't as intimidated. But for me, I'm an attorney. I've been an attorney for 25 plus years. I graduated law school and I did a mix of regulatory and contracting when I first got out, and then hated the regulatory and loved the contracts. And I've always been a commercial contracts lawyer, working with technology and things like that. I was in lots of law firms for about 10 years, including Big Law, which is kind of those really big global law firms. Then I spent about 14 years in-house working on contracts to buy, sell, and license stuff. And we handled everything from the $3,000 thing to the many millions of dollars things. And so I've worked in small companies. I've worked in big companies. I have a startup myself. There's just so much different kinds of contracting. And so was always my love. I love doing the contracts. I love negotiating them. I love the strategizing and the puzzle making that is involved with contracts. So a couple of years ago, I started posting online contract tip every day. And that kind of ballooned into a whole contract training business, which is How to Contract. So that's my big story of how I got involved in contracts and bringing that expertise that I gained over my 25-year career and sharing it with people. So those who don't have a lot of training in contracts, which is a lot of people, I can help them learn how we do it in the real world, not just as an academic subject.
That's fantastic. And for those people who are listening who have not seen Laura's amazing tip of the day cartoons, oh my God, you have to follow her on LinkedIn. Do you put them anywhere else besides LinkedIn, Laura, or is it just LinkedIn?
They're in the only other place is my membership. So people who join get access to all of them.
But... Oh, fantastic. They're great cartoons. I don't know how you come up with them, but I laugh out loud whenever I see them. So that is amazing. I'd like to start out with sort of this question because it gets people to think a little bit about the topic that we're discussing. So when people think about contracts, what would you say that people get wrong? What concept or theme about contracts do people get wrong when you're working with them?
Yeah, I think for people who don't have a heavy contract experience, they become like frozen and they're intimidated by the language. They don't understand all the concepts, so they don't read it, or they back themselves into a corner. They avoid it. They don't read it that closely. And then they're forced to sign it and they're nervous and there's just so much anxiety. So that's what I would say that they get wrong, because at the end of the day, contract's just a summary of a business relationship. And even though there are lots of legalistic words and concepts, most of it you can understand, anybody can understand, if you approach it as a summary of the relationship and just don't worry too much about all the legalistic stuff and just really focus on the core business elements of your relationship.
I really like that summary of a business relationship. That's a great way to think about contracting. So a lot of times in the third sector, charities and nonprofits, particularly again, small to medium size, they don't have lawyers that they can rely on. So how would you suggest if they want to, for example, come up with a contracted template themselves because they're not necessarily interested in using something that comes from a vendor, they're concerned about it. What are some ways that these small organizations can come up with documentation that would help them, protect them, so that they can have a suite of resources that they can draw from when it comes to contracting?
Yeah, the one thing I would say is if you're not going to have a lawyer involved, keep it short. You are better off with a less legalistic agreement that both parties can understand than you are downloading something complicated from the internet that you're not quite sure what it means and all these long provisions. Because the law generally will fill in the gaps in most cases if the contract doesn't cover it. For example, I'll use the case of force majeure, which is when a terrible disaster happens and one of the parties can't perform. And so the law already has that built in. And so if your contract doesn't say anything on force majeure and what happens if there's a flood or pandemic or explosion, then we would look to the law. And so it's nice to have it if you can. I think it gives you some control, but you're worse off including something that doesn't make sense or goes against you than you are not having it in your contract in many cases. So I think that's one. And what I tell people who don't have a lawyer who are facing a relatively simple relationship is you can write a letter, have a bullet list of terms that say, we each agree the relationship is this. You'll perform these services. I'll pay you this money. And that's it. And then sign that piece of paper. Because now at least you have something on paper that both parties, all the commercial terms you've agreed to. And again, you're letting the law fill in the blanks of what's not in there.
So basically, organizations shouldn't be too worried about all of the superfluous details, so to speak, and maybe keeping it short and sweet is not that dangerous.
So the times that I wouldn't keep it short and sweet, where you need the legal terms, and I would suggest you need to get a lawyer, and lawyers don't have to do a full edit. I've had lots of clients who say, can you review this one section for me and let me know if I need to change it? And the issues that are particularly worrisome are anytime there's going to be potential for injury, physical injury, something like that, that you'd want some kind of contract for that. And then anytime if things go wrong, they'll go very wrong. So somebody is, I'm trying to think of an example. I have the cartoon, knife juggling for children. You know, you want that to have a contract because things could go wrong. And then any intellectual property. If you are hiring someone to create something for you that you should own or you need particular rights to, you definitely want to have those contract provisions in there because the law does not give you much in terms of rights to use if you don't have a contract.
That's great. And I'll put a plug in here. I have a previous episode on intellectual property risks in the third sector with an IP lawyer. So check out that one if people are listening to this episode now. You just mentioned a few risks, things where people can really get hurt, IP. What would be the top three areas of risk, specifically if you're looking at it from a charity or a nonprofit point of view, that you think they should be aware of when it comes to contracting?
Yeah. So the way I suggest people look at it is start at the end. Don't think about what you're trying to do up front. Think about what could go wrong looking back at the end. And so if you look back at the end, what are the things, if everything goes wrong and your vendor doesn't do what they're supposed to do? What are the things, what are the tools you'll need? So one of them is being clear on the commercial points, such as the summary of the services or what deliverables they're going to get you. So those commercial descriptions, that's why I was saying a list with bullet points on core commercial things that are going to happen is so critical because those are often, I'd say 70% of the time, the contract dispute is over the commercial terms and a misunderstanding between the two parties. Oh, I didn't know you needed me to deliver this. I thought I was going to deliver that. So getting those commercial terms right, I think is the number one thing you got to take care of. And then the other thing is termination. When can you end the contract? It's so important because most of the times people aren't going to sue over a problem. Again, if it's huge, if it's intellectual property, if there's a personal injury, there will be probably lawsuits. But barring those situations, in most cases, there's just a disagreement and you're going to want to terminate. And some contracts might lock you in. They might have auto renewal. They might have a long term and you're going to be stuck paying for a very long time. So paying attention to your rights to terminate and whether that ends your payment obligation to them. And then the last one is a limit of liability. And limit of liabilities can feel scary, but it doesn't have to be. It can be very simple. It's accepted that when you have a commercial relationship, in most cases, again, barring personal injury or fraud or some narrow exceptions, you are allowed to limit your liability. And so what's most common is the value you're paying for the goods or services. So if you are a customer on the customer side, though, you may not want that limit of liability, or you may want to have a higher limit of liability if you could have damages. So thinking about that limit of liability, I think, is one of the most important things that you'll want to look at in the contract. And you can talk through it with your counterparty. It says, oh, you know, we're paying you $100,000 to do this service or whatever amount it is, and your limit of liability is $5,000. Wait, that doesn't make sense. And have that conversation with them and think about what, and especially from a company perspective, I have a lot of companies and clients I've worked with who have at a corporate level some standards relating to limits of liability because they've had those problems before. And they will say, we always exclude certain things from the limit of liability. For example, if there's a third party sues us over something the vendor did, that's always excluded from the limit of liability. So if people have access to some lawyers, having those conversations up front might be really useful about company policies and how you approach contracting. But to back up to the question, those are my three: the commercial terms, particularly price and exactly what they're going to do for you. And then the second is term and termination and making sure that you have an escape hatch if things aren't going well. And then the third one is limit of liability.
Those are all great. And I have to say, from my own experience, that termination one, and you mentioned auto renewal, I definitely want to flag that for people that are listening, because so many times that can be in some of these standard contracts, particularly for like software services, but even for other stuff, be aware of the auto renewal because it says you have to terminate 3 months ahead of time. And so you need to be on top of that or else, yeah, you're automatically going to be stuck for another service period. So that's a great point, Laura. I have a question about due diligence in contracting. This is an area that's really of great importance to nonprofits, particularly because donors and funders are expecting that charities and nonprofits are doing due diligence, for example, on their supply chain. So what are some ways that you could suggest or recommend that due diligence is either done or maybe written into a contract?
Yeah, I think one of the best ways to do it is a supplier questionnaire. So you're going to identify what areas of diligence do you need to do? And I'm just taking it from the purchasing side. What things are important about your vendors that you need to know? And then putting those out in a questionnaire. And the other cool thing that I see people do is they get the vendor to agree to the customer's policies as part of that questionnaire. So you provide the questionnaire, and then basically it's a box to check that says, yes, I agree to these policies. And that's super important for a lot of small businesses who maybe don't have the power to impose their policies on their vendors, but all you really need is just some obligation, and your donors will want to know that you've gotten that obligation from the vendor, and having that in that supplier questionnaire can work really well.
And would the supplier questionnaire be something that they would fill out, for example, while they're submitting a proposal, or would it be something that they would fill out at the time of the contract execution?
You know, it depends on the company. So I've seen some people use it as a gating item and they say, oh, you want to sell to our company. Here's a supplier questionnaire. Fill out this information and then submit it. and then we'll look at it. And then if we want to buy from you, we will. So basically, it allows you to get that information up front and that agreement to comply with your policies up front. Other times, I see it done after the order is placed, but before payment. And you say, you need to fill out this form in order to get payment. Here it is. Particularly, again, if you don't have a lawyer involved and you're kind of managing this process yourself, what you need to do is get some kind of documentation that the vendor has either agreed to follow your policies, your compliance policies, which is what a lot of diligence is about, or has provided you with information about their compliance with these standards that you're setting. And the supplier questionnaire format is a bit innocuous. What I see is people don't necessarily send that to their lawyers. They'll just fill it out. And if you have things in there, sometimes that's a way to take care of that diligence part of it without having to make it a legal complicated thing.
Those are great suggestions. Thanks. I can see the value in doing it as a selection criteria element, but then also the value of fill this out or you won't get paid. That's also a really good, some leverage you could have, I guess.
Exactly. Well, there's some risk with that. If you have a signed contract and it doesn't say anything about the questionnaire. But the one thing to remember is that vendors are your best friend during the sales process. They are trying to please you. They want you to be happy. They're calling you. They're checking. You know, they're salespeople. And then once the contract is signed, they tend to disappear a little bit. And they may not be as responsive and they may not be as forthcoming. So the more compliance, diligence, information that you can get before signature, the better, when they're still motivated. Because once they've locked you into a contract, of course, you hope they're motivated, but they don't have any legal requirement unless it's written in the contract.
That's great advice. Yeah, I think you're right about that. If it's not in the contract, then maybe waiting till the end might not be the best idea. If you have a small to medium-sized organization, you know, it's a local environmental charity or maybe working with the elderly or animals or whatever it is, how would you advise the leadership and management of the organization to engage a little bit more in the contracting, not be afraid of it? How can this be built into the ways of working so that the organization is on top of contracting?
Yeah, I think, again, my best tool is to look at it at the end. Imagine you're hiring this vendor and it's all going to go wrong. What kinds of things could go wrong? And again, it's usually pricing and termination or what the scope of services is. So if you are in those leadership roles, what you want to make sure is that your team is documenting exactly what is going to be paid and when, and exactly what services are going to be performed by when. The other thing that they can really do is encourage their people to create milestones in their contracts. So payment is dependent upon receiving some specific deliverable, a report, access, whatever it is, services. So you pay when the services are performed with minimal payment, ideally no payment upfront, but minimal payment upfront, that there always should be some payment tied to deliverables. Again, kind of goes back to that idea I mentioned before that once the contract's signed and the organization has a contractual obligation to pay this vendor, it gets hard because if they don't perform, but they perform part of it, but not all of it, there's a little bit of a gray area of how much you're going to have to pay, what you'll have to pay. What if they didn't deliver, you know, they delivered one and two, but not three. How much of the flat fee do we have to pay? So thinking about the nature of the service you're hiring and making sure you have that clarity. And as a leader, you're ensuring and providing that feedback to your team of saying, hey, before you sign the contract, could you send it over to me? And then having a conversation with the person about, okay, if things go wrong, what can we do? And what choices will we have? And I think that kind of question from the management of the organization can have a big impact on that front line because they're thinking, oh, I do need to think about if things go wrong. Because that's ultimately what a contract is. If it was, you know, we could just shake on it and count on each other, we wouldn't need contracts. So we need contracts for if things go wrong. And we don't worry about them too much if they don't. So really, if you ask the questions of your frontline team so that they are thinking about it and they get it written down, you can't rely on anything that's said orally. You can have a lawsuit and try and enforce oral promises, but those are very difficult. So you really want to make sure anything that's important to you that you think should be a breach of the contract if they don't do needs to be written down and explained. And again, tying payment to those deliverables is another great tool for making sure that the front line is getting contracts that really commit the vendor to do things and that you don't have to pay until things happen.
I think that's such a great suggestion about starting from the end and saying, what could go wrong? And I could very easily see this type of questioning built into a risk assessment. And that's again, because you know this is my background, and saying, okay, well, in our area of procurement, in our area of vendor management, in our area of contracting, was a what could go wrong analysis done, so to speak, and making sure that people are really building that in, whether it's a checklist or whether it's just a question prompt to have that conversation. Like you said, if it's built into the business process, then they're probably better off.
Yeah. And I think just knowing, I mean, even for me as an employee, when I hear senior management asking me about something, then I'm thinking, oh, that's important to them. And I take more care with those issues going forward. So I think having the senior management or the board ask the operational staff about contracts, about limits of liability, about termination and auto renewal, I think that would go a very long way to making sure that the team is also focused on those issues.
That's excellent. And then this takes me to my next question, moving up a step on the chain. What three questions do you think board members could ask relating to risks surrounding contracts? Because a lot of times board members in nonprofits and charities or volunteers, their hearts are in the right place. They're passionate about the mission of the particular organization, but they don't really have experience being on a board. I've talked to a lot of first-time trustees and board members, and they're really afraid to speak up. They don't want to embarrass themselves. They don't want to create more work. So what kind of questions can they ask to learn more and make sure that they're really overseeing contract risk?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing they can do is create a clear policy and procedure around contracting. So one of the things I see is when you leave it to the front line to elevate contracts to the board or executive management without any criteria, that frontline person's going to pick and choose what to elevate. Some might not send much along, some will send everything. So I think a clear approval matrix for your contracts is really useful. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can just be any contract with intellectual property over this amount of money or that involves personal injury risk needs to get elevated to the executive or to the board. So I think working with your team to identify which areas are risky for your entity, because you don't need to see every little, you know, I signed up for a online platform that's $30 a year or $30 a month. Maybe you don't need to see those terms because you're just getting access to content. But if you have a company coming in to develop a new software program that you're going to offer your members, and you're doing a bunch of customization internally to help implement that, well, then that's probably something that the board wants to see. So providing that information of what you want to see and memorializing that in a document or procedure that you can give your frontline team that communicates that standard in a formal way, I think is really, really helpful. And then having a checklist of what terms are okay and what terms aren't okay. So things like, we do not assign our intellectual property to anyone unless the president of the organization approves. We do not agree to limits of liability, or we do not agree to auto renewal, or whatever kinds of standards you can set those. And not necessarily that you want to enter into the contract because you might not have a choice since you don't have the bargaining power in many cases. But at least those risks are getting escalated to the right people. We're going to make an informed choice about it. And also to the point of your subject matter of risk, those are the people, the executives are the ones who have the perspective of risk management for the entire organization. So one individual in HR who's faced with a contract may not understand the implications of assigning IP to the vendor, whereas the president or somebody in charge or the board is going to have a bigger picture view of the risk facing the company and saying, you know what, in this instance, we're okay with this risk, but they can't make that decision unless they know about it. And for them to know about it, the frontline folks need escalation standards for the contracting of when they bring things up.
Those are great suggestions. So having a clear delegation of authority, something that's written down so that people know who can actually sign and bind the organization is really important. And then also your point about escalation. I love your suggestion of having just cheat sheet of what we do and do not agree to. And that might be something that takes a little bit of effort up front, but certainly will be worth the time and could also scale with the organization as the organization grows and engages in more contracts and having that cheat sheet available for folks who may be engaging. And I like what you talked about with if you escalate it, we can always waive it, right? But we're having a documented and well thought through waiver to allow us to engage with whatever it is we need. But we're having a conversation around that heightened risk instead of someone just kind of bulldozing into a contract and not realizing it. Those are great suggestions, Laura. Thanks. Talking about low to no resource environments, and I'm sure a lot of folks that are listening to the episode today are going to say, okay, I'm not as scared as I was a few minutes ago about contracts, but I want to learn more. So what are some free or low cost resources that you can suggest to folks who are listening today where they can learn a little bit more about contracting, maybe read or listen to something or reach out to a community of practice for folks so that they can continue their education around contracts they're asked to do them in the future?
Yeah. So, you know, start with my resources, which is if you're on LinkedIn, and make sure you connect with me. I'm an open connector. So I accept everybody unless you're trying to sell me a particular something. So I post a contract tip every day. And these are written as very casual, informal, easy to read tips that are generally applicable. And I have a lot of people who aren't lawyers who follow and learn from them. So I also have the tips in a book. And then we have a newsletter each week where we are sharing a lot of the tips there and links to other resources, free webinars, things like that. There are other resources available as well. And one of the great ones is Contract Nerds, which is run by a woman named Nedelfa Najafi. And she has a clearinghouse of articles on so many different subjects. She also has a page on her website with her recommended contract resources. So there's probably about 50 different places to look for contract information on there, some free, some paid, but some of the top books and websites and other sources. And then the other one, it's a little bit non-conventional, but it's a company called Term Scout, which I have a relationship with. And I love them because they have a free plan and you can get information particularly about IT contracts. And we all know there's a million different software as a service products that we all use as the world has moved on to the cloud. And Term Scout rates each of those and highlights which terms are not standard or which terms many customers have issues with. So if there's auto renewal, it'll highlight that. If there's no cap or if there's a low cap on the vendor's liability, it'll highlight that. If there's no confidentiality obligation, it'll highlight that. So I love that as a way to learn. And even if you just poke around on their site and look at the free account and you can read about the kinds of issues that other companies won't sign contracts with or things that everybody accepts and that's very standard. So it's another great way to learn.
Those are great suggestions. I love it. I had never heard of Contract Nerds or Term Scout before, so I'm going to have to check those out myself. And then, of course, just to repeat, your site is howtocontract.com, right?
That's right. And I also have a book, find it on Amazon. It's called Practical Tips for How to Contract. And it's a little different. It's not like most law books. There's no statutes. There's no cases. It's not dense. Instead, I put a contract tip on each page with a cartoon. And I've got about, I think the book ended up with 330-ish contract tips, and they're really easy to read and easy to understand. And the cartoons, of course, are what draws people in.
The cartoons are great. I love them. I've seen butterflies and chainsaws lately, lots of volcanoes and zombies. I'm such a huge fan of the contracts, Laura. And your How to Contract community, too. If people join that community, they can get access to some resources, maybe even some events, or they could reach out to other folks within the community. Is that a possibility?
Yeah. So we we have a membership that's available. And with the membership, you get access to the full library of content that I have. We also, it's separate from the library, but we also have paid events. We've got the annual Contracts Con in February. And then we also have smaller paid events, as well as a ton of free webinars. And with the free webinars, I'll often bring on experts who will share practical tips. So we might look at a contract provision together and redline it, or we might talk about a particular issue that's facing people, cybersecurity, insurance, and what should people do. Or just did a webinar with a tax lawyer who explained tax provisions and an expert compliance lawyer who explained export control provisions. So I do a lot of programming that's really focused on the fundamentals and helping people learn. And if it's not a paid event, all those videos go into the library. And as well as I created a ton of content, there's probably about 50 to 60 hours of training. I've got 50 plus contract tools of negotiation scripts, annotated provisions, guides, all the different things you might need if you're trying to learn contracting. And again, my focus, there's other contract books out there, but they tend to focus more on it, almost what I think of as an academic approach. Like in a model world, this is the perfect provision. And that's not the world I live in. In my world, there is no perfect provision. It depends. It's context-based, and it's always dependent on what kind of leverage you have. And often we don't have any. So I really try to explain things so you can make that business decision about, okay, this isn't the perfect provision, but it's okay because these are the risks and I'm okay with those risks. So to do that, you need that information. You need to understand the issue enough so that you can make that informed risk. And my content, my training, my book, everything I do is really designed for people who don't have formal contract training from an experienced, capable contract lawyer or mentor.
That's fantastic. And for my little risk heart, bringing contracting back to making informed risk decisions, that just makes me so happy. Because at the end of the day, like you were saying in the very beginning, contracts are really just a summary of a business relationship. And we just want to make sure that we're entering into that relationship aware of the risks and the ones we want to accept and the ones we don't. So I love how you boil this down to something that's so simple. And hopefully people aren't too afraid of contracts anymore now.
Not only don't be afraid, but contracts can be very fun. And there's a whole community of us on LinkedIn that just really enjoy it because it combines a lot of different elements. One is you're describing the business relationship. Well, what is it? What do we want to do? So that's kind of interesting because that's what your organization is doing. So you're describing how you're working with somebody. And two, it's language. It's making sure you're using the right words. And not worrying about the legal right words, but sort of like, well, what are they doing? Are they going to deliver something by this date? Is there a different way to say that? Or do we not need it by that date? And so there's a little bit of a puzzle in there as well. Which words do we want to use that make the most sense? And so there's an intellectual, there's a creative element to it as well. So if you can just avoid worrying too much about the really dense provisions like indemnification, you know, at the end of the day rarely comes up in for most businesses unless you're like a huge multinational technology company or you have a lot of personal injury or property damage stuff. Indemnity doesn't come up for most of us. So don't worry too much about that. At least that'd be my advice. And just focus in on having a contract that reads for what you want and don't be intimidated by it. It's really, as I said, just that document. But they can be fun. And it's a fun area to learn about because it's so cross-dimensional. It covers tax, export compliance, it's payment, accounting, revenue recognition. You have to learn all these cool areas that are tangential to it. And the last thing I'll say is contracts are forgiving. And one of the reasons I love working on contracts is there's never a perfect contract. And I talk about it that I work very hard to make sure there's no mistakes in any contracts I do, but I can guarantee there's a mistake in almost everyone. Because again, they're not perfect. They're not sitting in a museum. They are working documents that we do and sometimes don't have enough time or have other issues. So being able to see them that way and that you don't have to be perfect and you don't have to know everything, I think takes away the intimidation and can make them more fun.
Amazing. I think that's exactly what people in the third sector needed to hear, Laura. So everybody grab Laura's book, check out her community of practice around contracts. And Laura, thank you so much for your time today. The third sector really appreciates your giving of your time and your knowledge.
Oh, yeah. No, my pleasure. My pleasure. I'm so happy to support this community.
Thanks. So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.